So we're going to use this case as a way to start to get into the issue of side effects and toxicity of CAR T therapy. And I guess one question that comes up, Krishna, is what kind of shape does somebody have to be in performance status wise in order to be able to be considered for CAR T therapy? And, you know, we think about, for example, autologous transplant as something that we don't think about in 80-year-olds, et cetera. What about criteria to receive CAR T, particularly, you know, you have a patient who doesn't have any options, Krishna?
Great question. Only correct you slightly, and that's that we just looked at our last 212 transplants that we performed, autologous transplants for lymphoma and myeloma, and we had one death out of those 200 and something, 16 transplants. And we are now actually starting to do transplants in 75 to 80-year-olds, even for lymphoma, but really with almost low mortality. I think it's very important to know that in general, the easiest way to say that is we can treat patients with CAR T cells who appear to be sicker than the average patient who's a candidate for autologous transplant. And importantly, and it's a complicated story, but trials that led to approval were done generally with healthier patients. And there are a lot of studies that Dr. Neelapu and I and others have been a part of that basically showed that about half of the people who are being treated with the approved products wouldn't have qualified for the trials that led to their approval. They tend to be older, they tend to be sicker, and yet, I think remarkably, they tend to have about the same responses that the patients did in the original clinical trials. Now, a few percent of people actually will have serious life-threatening and even fatal complications. That's been true. It's a little bit hard to get the exact numbers. So this is probably not less likely to lead to death than an autologous transplant, but these patients are typically refractory patients who wouldn't necessarily qualify. And age, there doesn't appear to be an upper limit. There are patients who have been treated well into their 80s. I think the oldest two patients in the registries are about 89 years old. So there is no upper limit. And I think one of the key things, I think, for people who refer to us is get patients to us early and don't assume that you know who will or won't be a candidate. Let us do that. We can usually get people in within 1 to 3 days. That, you know, there are some gymnastics in terms of approvals and other things, but quickly get on the phone, talk to us. We'll let you know whether we think that it's a reasonable prospect. So before you throw in the towel, you know, let us evaluate that, and we can usually quickly do that.
So we want to focus in terms of the toxicity on two major issues: cytokine release syndrome and neurotoxicity. And also, I'm curious about some of the apps that are out there to help people manage these problems. Starting with cytokine release, Bettina, can you comment? This lady had some element of cytokine release. Can you talk about sort of when it starts, how it usually presents, and how you manage it?
This lady, she did have some cytokine release. With the product that she received, typically you would see an onset a few days later than she had an onset of day 2 after cell infusion. And typically it presents with a fever. Patients can also have hypoxia and hypotension. They can have organ toxicities. However, the organ toxicities currently are not part of our grading system that we're using at my institution. However, we do monitor for them. But typically patients will present with a fever during this time period, and we do warn patients and their families about that. A little bit after the cytokine release has its average appearance, we see the neurotoxicity after that. But for her, she had fevers and I believe also some hypotension and tachycardia as well at that time.
And we'll talk a little bit about the neurotoxicity. Nikhil, can you comment a little bit about cytokine storm? You know, we hear that term nowadays a lot as it relates to COVID. Can you kind of compare the two?
Yeah, so basically cytokine release syndrome or cytokine storm comes about because of this massive growth of the immune cell, which is observed. Partly it is necessary because when the CAR T cell recognizes tumor cell, binds to it and kills it, in the process, because of this genetic manipulation, they are programmed to grow. And they grow 1,000-fold, 10,000-fold, and even more. And this sudden, very acute growth of the immune cell also leads to production of various cytokines, various chemicals by these T cells and immune cells. These cytokines are in general meant for the immune cells to help each other to be even more robust. But the side effect ends up being that it also overwhelms the system. There are many other impacts on the body. For example, the commonest side effect Bettina described is fever. And fever happens because of this increase in IL-6, interleukin-6. And that's one of the cytokines that I can mention. There are many other cytokines. So an acute growth or changes in the immune cell is on one side. what happens in COVID is in some ways similar. When one gets a severe infection, the COVID-related infection, that, for example, is localized into the lung system as a, to start with, there is intense inflammatory response that happens locally. And a lot of inflammatory cytokines are produced in the process, which is body's immune process to sort of control it. But in the process of controlling it, there are a lot of cytokines produced as a control mechanism that in fact end up causing more damage because it's an uncontrolled production of all these cytokines. And that in some ways similar to what we observe in the cytokine release syndrome with the CAR T cell. And then we begin to know what the treatments are, and we'll discuss, talk more about it. But interleukin 6 is the cytokine that causes the biggest, most prominent impact. IL-1 is other, and there were a few other cytokines which are of importance, TNF-alpha, interferon alpha, etc. But IL-6 being one of the major cytokines, giving the most prominent impact with fever and respiratory issues and hypoxias and cardiac impact, etc., the treatment ends up being to block it. Tocilizumab or IL-6 receptor antibodies, one, you can use IL-6 receptor. Steroids is part of the same process because it can decrease interleukin-6. And as you see, begin to see the COVID literature, which is still evolving, tocilizumab ends up being one of the important treatments for it. And it also provides benefit in quite a significant way. So this cytokine storm is not a necessary evil, but it's something that we do observe. It is connected in many cases with the response. There are patients who do not get it and still respond. So you don't have to have it, but it's present, as you will see, in majority of the patient in myeloma, it's 80 to 90% of the time of different grades. And it can be treated because we can go after the cytokine and control it. And that's how use of this control mechanism have increased, and the treatments are becoming safer and also becoming less toxic as we move on with understanding of this process.
Tiffany, any comments about both cytokine release and neurotoxicity in myeloma patients? I think you mentioned earlier that it seems like maybe it's not as intense in the myeloma patients. Any comment on that, Tiffany?
Yeah, so for CRS, you know, we do see about 80% of patients that will develop CRS, but of those, only about 6% in various trials develop grade 3 or grade 4. So it's mostly going to be grade 1 and grade 2. And same with ICANS, we do see grade 1 and grade 2 on neurotoxicity, but again, the grade 3 and grade 4 neurotoxicity is a very low percentage. And so I think for us, when we're talking about the side effects of CAR T with our myeloma patients, we do have that advantage, and patients are not as scared about the side effects because I think CAR T has been around enough now that our patients hear about what's happening in lymphoma. And in our center, our myeloma patients share a lobby with the lymphoma patients. So there's a lot of crosstalk that happens between patients. And so I think that is one definite advantage that our myeloma patients do have.
Of course, the good news here is, as opposed to many of the therapies, chemotherapy, et cetera, we use, this only occurs, you know, one time. You're only treated once. So it's not at least a chronic situation. Yeah. Bettina, the other big issue is neurotoxicity. You referred to it. It sounds like your lady really didn't have much of a problem. I think you were mentioning the double vision she'd had previously. But when you do see neurotoxicity, Bettina, when do you tend to see it, and what do you usually see?
I will say that I have seen it happen actually earlier than what most of the data would suggest, but on average, you're going to see it a little bit later, around day 7, about a week after they get the cells. It can vary from patient to patient, but I would say in my experience, especially with lymphoma patients, what I have observed is you'll see somebody, especially if you've been seeing them in the prior days, who's been very sharp, take a little bit more time to process information. When they're performing the ICE score assessment with our nursing staff, you'll see that they can still answer orientation questions and do serial subtraction. However, they might have to think about it a little bit more than normal, and that will progress to often them having issues being able to answer questions, some expressive aphasia, some general confusion. Just, I would say we get a handwriting sample. You'll see that somebody will go from being able to give you a very nice, neat handwriting sample to something that looks kind of jarbled and doesn't make any sense.
Of course, Safa, a key thing here down mentioned at the bottom is that this is reversible. I don't know if we even understand why people get that. You had a paper where you looked at the handwriting of patients, kind of gets into some of the subtle signs of the neurotoxicity that you really kind of have to look for. Can you comment on that?
So when we were first doing these trials, we were doing the 30-point mini mental status exams on these patients. And we noticed that one of the earliest signs of neurotoxicity in these patients appears to be this impairment of handwriting. So you can see in this particular patient on day 4, her handwriting was normal. Her baseline MMSE score was 29 over 30. But on day 5, she has significant impairment of her handwriting, but she was still able to answer most of the other questions, such as orientation to time, place, etc. She could name her family members and so forth, but the handwriting was markedly impaired. So with her MMSE score being 27 over 30. And by the next day, you could see that her handwriting returned back to baseline. So there are elements in the neurological exam that we find to be affected very early on. So one is the handwriting, and the other is their inability to count the numbers backwards. So we generally assess this by the ability to count backwards from 100 by 10. This is part of the new consensus grading system that was put forward by the ASTCT. It's now done by nurse practitioners, physicians at the bedside, can be done several times a day. It's just a 10-point score. For each correct answer, we assign a point. And again, even in the 10-point score, one of them is to look at their ability to write a sentence. And that's usually one of the ones that's most affected early on.
So Krishna, any comments on both CRS as well as neurotoxicity? And is this virtually always reversible, Krishna, or do you sometimes see long-term sequelae? What typically happens in these patients?
At a really high level, the CRS tends to happen the first week. The neurotoxicity tends to happen kind of the end of the first week to the second week. It almost always responds and resolves completely. A small subset of patients will have, you know, very serious complications and can even die, even in the myeloma studies where it's much more rare, but still deaths have been reported. But I think for patients who get past that, and the vast majority of them will, they will return to virtually normal function. There are some studies of long-term cognitive function to see if there are any issues. You know, I think the only other thing I would say is that Dr. Nilipu said, you know, he and I and others worked to kind of standardize these grading systems. And you asked about apps. The ASTCT actually has an app, and you know, there's actually a grading calculators. You can't really see this on my thing, but there's a Cartox app, and then the ASTCT has an app that's freely downloadable from the App Store, and you can actually put it in. You can put in, it'll tell you the ICE score, the ICANS score, and the overall ASTCT grading system, which is now the consensus grading system. The early trials of these different products actually use three different grading systems, so it's really hard to compare exactly across trials what the incidence of neurotoxicity or cytokine release syndrome was. It was one of the reasons that Dr. Nilipu and I actually helped to lead that effort to really standardize the grading system. And that was an important thing. And now we have a very solid kind of consistent grading system.
So Tiffany, we showed the picture of the app from MD Anderson. There's a bunch of different apps and different guidelines. Any comments about utilizing these kinds of approaches in managing patients, Tiffany?
Yeah, an app that MD Anderson developed is really useful, and it was actually developed by one of our research nurse practitioners. She worked with our IT department. And so it's easy. You can put in what symptoms the patients are having. It'll tell you the grade, and then it'll also provide the management for you so that it's quick. You can quickly look at it in order to be able to provide the best management for the patient. So I think these apps are really, really handy, particularly for nurses, nurse practitioners, if you're starting to see changes in your patients, that you can quickly identify what's happening with your patient.
So we're going to go to another case and try to get a little more into what happens to these people, particularly when they get some of these complications. But Krishna, maybe you can comment on sort of right now where CAR-T is being done and where you see in the future, if we're going to have more and more CAR-T patients, how it's going to be filtered out into the community. It seems the transplanters are going to be doing this.
Well, I wouldn't say it's transplanted. For example, Dr. Nilipu is one of the leading figures in the field and is not a transplant doc, but he's, you know, really, I think, become a cell therapist. And I think one of the things that we would say, you know, there's some disagreement around this, but I would say it's a general consensus that this should be done in experienced centers that can recognize and develop a multidisciplinary approach. And in that sense, there are a lot of parallels with transplant. For both transplant and these immune effector cell therapies, there's an accrediting organization, and the ASTCT and the ISCT actually came together to develop an organization called FACT, which actually provides a set of standards that get frequently revised, and they created a set of immune effector cell standards. I think if you ask, you know, the physicians on this panel or others, we would tell you, go to a center that has FACT accreditation for immune effector cell therapies. Right now, that's a relatively high bar that requires you to be treated in one of around 100-ish centers for each of the two products. It means that we're not delivering it in rural oncology clinics, but that provides an assurance and a checklist and a multidisciplinary approach that is vetted. And I think that that's important. It's kind of an accreditation process. I think as products become less toxic, certainly we're seeing a big difference between the CD19 products and the BCMA products that Dr. Munshi is going to tell us more about. We're going to see safer administration. And I think at some point it will be safer. My feeling is that these should always be done in the context of a program that has some kind of external validation and accreditation. And I think that standard will change and it will allow more community-based care, but it provides an assurance both to payers and to physicians who are referring, nurses who are referring, and to patients themselves that set of standards and environment is safe. And I think that's really critical right now.
So we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about sort of how these strategies fit into these three settings, these clinical settings where CAR T therapy has been utilized. We'll also talk in the end a little bit about where things might be heading in the future, whether or not we can learn from what happened here with CAR T to develop other therapies that may be less expensive, less toxic, maybe off the shelf without having to be autologous. We'll talk about that in a second. But let's talk about sort of where CAR T fits in terms of myeloma.